You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, you're listening to The Orthodox Nationalist. I am Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this is being recorded on August 3rd, 2024. Although today, the date isn't all that important since it's an evergreen topic. But in case you hadn't noticed, I have been dealing almost with exclusively Russia-Ukraine topics for a while. And so today I want to go elsewhere. I want to go to China. If you remember, about a year ago, I promised I said that I have a book on China coming out at the beginning of 2024, and that's to a great extent finished. The only thing I have to do is to standardize the forms of citation. Because these are essays from all over the place, and they have different methods. I tend to use a hybrid of the APA and the APSA methods, and try to use just the simplest variation that I can. So, the basic thesis that we're dealing with is that China, and I initially got this idea from Willis Cardo, is in no way Maoist or a Marxist or a communist state in any way. It is a social nationalist or a national socialist state. And the details of that is really to a great extent, both in policy and in theory, what we're going to do and what this book is about. Now, of course, I'm only going to be summarizing a fairly small part of this book, but it's really divided into two parts. The first is more the theoretical elements, and the second part is actual policy, especially foreign policy, that is to say Chinese foreign policy. And I bring this up now, early August 2024, because if somehow, by some miracle, Donald Trump is elected president, China is going to be the new target. Less so Russia, although Russia's still going to be in the crosshairs. This is a ruling class idea, and no single politician has the power to change much of that. But at least in terms of the State Department, Defense Department, the focus will move to China. And we all know the Lindsey Graham, you know, the old John McCain back when he was still drawing breath, idea that China was a Marxist country that stamps out all forms of dissent, as of course the Western liberals were stamping out all forms of dissent. And worse, 4 years ago, China somehow is responsible for COVID-19. As the war continues to wind down in Ukraine, it heats up in the Middle East, and the China-Taiwan issue, China-Hong Kong issue, has languished a little bit. And I don't think that's going to last too long. Now, I don't claim to be a historian of China, but I have been studying Chinese politics for a very long time. And because China and Russia are allies, they're both land powers, they both have a lot in common, it's extremely important to understand what's happening, because as always, the intellectual framework doesn't exist, at least in the popular mind, to judge what's happening there. I have done lectures on Maoism and what Maoist China was. And I don't remember, that was maybe 6 months ago, maybe more. And I stated that the horrors of Maoism were such that really, historians don't have a vocabulary to describe it. But by 1990, it was, just to say the least, implausible to identify China as a Marxist system, despite the rhetoric. Post-Mao China initially was anti-liberal, it was ideologically driven, and was in a state of economic stagnation. And this is largely the fault of Mao himself. China had lost 30, 40, 50 million people. And the economy, you know, Mao died in 1976. China's economy was a hierarchy of classes, possibly influenced on the margins by, as the years went on, personal profit and some developing market exchange. But it was all still dominated by the state, and to some extent remains the case. Until roughly 2000, information was controlled by the party. And you did have punishment of dissenters if those dissenters were seen to be actors of a foreign power. The nation's police forces were party-based, not national, not regional. But of course, that will change in the years after Mao's death. So the party, at that point, created a general program of very rapid industrialization, although not the method that Mao used, because his collectivization was far more violent and far more miserable than Stalin's. But initially, labor was paid fairly low wages, although in a society that had a low cost of living, and it was within a generalized state plan of building basic infrastructure. The infrastructure that has to exist to undergird any form of industrialization. So he had something along the lines of a discretionary market. It was a conditional permission to profit from the ownership and employment of any kind of capital. And those controls that were placed on that were to a great extent relaxed. I've made the argument that it's proper to say that post-Mao China was almost a form of therapy. Since if Maoism wasn't traumatic, then nothing is. But what was developing in Peking and elsewhere was a variant of social nationalism or national socialism. Something quite different from Leninist planning, though. The Western world sees its ideology, essentially oligarchy and plutocracy, functioning under the guise of, you know, democracy and liberalism, as something to take for granted. That this is what they're supposed to do, and to the extent they don't move in that direction, they're doing something wrong. But the phrase representative democracy is way too broad a term for most uses. But over 100 years ago, the work of Sun Yat-sen made it fairly mainstream. Of course, representation and democratic procedures are two very different things. Sun, one of the great theoreticians of modern China, saw the U.S. and its three branches of government as essential. He talked about mass suffrage, referendums, and of course China's role in this capitalist Darwinian struggle of international political economy. And even back then, in the wake of the, you know, several generations before the Opium Wars, a strong, well-organized state was absolutely essential. The old monarchy, for all of its virtues, wasn't able to defeat the British. So Sun saw a interventionist state, a patriotic state, controlling the fundamentals of the developing economy. And that was the developmental state. He even looked to Lenin's new economic policy as some possibility. But internationalism was one thing that all Marxists have to accept, but it was rejected. Then and rejected after Mao's death, since it really has no content. It isn't anything. Sun argued that Marxism and Leninism, they were meant to approach the problems of the European powers, not those of what Mao later would, you know, call the Third World. Now, Sun advocated a form of popular sovereignty, which is not the same thing as liberal democracy, but that self-government, that is to say, representative government, is the foundation of any country. And that is perfectly consistent with nationalism as true representation. Now, after Mao died in 1976, the architect of today's China was Deng Xiaoping. And among the four cardinal principles he left, the fundamental axioms of the new state, are the democratic dictatorship and single-party dominance. That is, the party is representative of most Chinese. Strangely, the fourth one is to maintain Mao Zedong thought. But I tend to think that that's symbolic. He introduced a limited conception of private property and market, but he also said that China could never allow a bourgeoisie to develop that would seek to limit the power of the party. The party was the only thing that could unify the country sufficiently to oversee the economy as a whole. Now, this has nothing to do with Maoism. That makes sense for any developing state. Reform, of course, came from the top down, not necessarily imposed by foreigners like you had in Russia, Ukraine. But it was implemented at the regional and local levels. The state that Deng Xiaoping and Jiang Zemin put together, no one can argue that it's not a huge success. But if you're going to connect it to a European ideology, I say it's social nationalism or some variant of national socialism. The point was to lay out some variation of, you know, private property and market relations without enabling an oligarchy, without enabling a bourgeoisie to adopt liberalism. Now, for a very long time, nationalism was based on protecting a country, especially in the third world, from foreign capital. For the protective coding for the ethno-nation, protection from huge capitalist enterprises taking over. China was seeking sovereignty, the redress of past injustices, everything that came out of the Opium Wars. And the Chinese were able to take markets and resources from the unstable liberal systems of the West. And that's really the only reason why the regime despises them, since Western capital has a tough time taking advantage of the country's success and of course, ultimately to control it. I was reading Jonathan Walton's 2008 monograph called The Revival of Chinese Nationalism, Challenges to American Ideals and Interests in East Asia. Now, the title alone gives you some indication, and this is really from a purely American and liberal point of view. But starting in the 1980s, early 80s, once the death of Mao and his successors was institutionalized, Chinese intellectuals were aware of four areas of crisis. The first was an ideological one, the downfall of Mao's ideology, without much to replace it, something, of course, that was a huge crisis in Russia. There was a contradiction, allegedly, between the market that the state was talking about and their constant references to Mao, or at least Marxism. The moral crisis was something about tradition, the decline of the authority of elites, because there was a tremendous level of corruption that came into existence given the leadership vacuum in the capital. The third is the institutional crisis. And this has to do with the lack of the Western conception of the rule of law, relative both to state function and the economy. But the rule of law in this case is what has to take the place of Maoism, which was simply arbitrary rule by a party with a very vague ideological agenda. And finally, and this has largely been solved, the pragmatic crisis, that given the torture that the party put China through, the party state apparatus didn't have any public trust. It's no longer an issue because, again, no one could deny the success of the so-called Communist Party of China. Now, this kind of implies that Maoism was ever an ideological consensus that a country may embrace. No, Maoism was a war on China, not a unifying ideology. Maybe it had rhetorical elements. But other than the Korean War, the Western powers never had a problem with China during the worst of Mao's mass murders, nor of its client, Cambodia. But the crisis that China faced was rebuilding, using what remained, but the foundation still has to be present. Maoism didn't unify anyone or anything, but Mao's bloodthirsty movement, however, did. That's not much of a foundation. So there had to have a coherent and compelling framework that the new China can be built upon, with Mao behind them, including his allies, but still not lacking leadership and a trustworthy elite. Now, of course, the West doesn't have that whatsoever. And as the market reforms in the 80s and 90s developed, you did have somewhat of a liberal class. And that meant a bourgeoisie. And the answer to that was Tiananmen. And you know that there was no massacre there. I've dealt with that before, on June of 1989. But at least as a rhetorical matter, it was an answer. The post-Deng Xiaoping party leadership came up with some kind of a median consensus. You did have pro-Western reformers like Zhao, but it wasn't the inequality that provoked protest. It was the oligarchy itself coming from Western ideology. It was that of an elite stratum of the population motivated by profit and hence the limitation on party control. But given what happened from 90 to 95 in the Eastern Bloc, the Westernizers had zero case. In fact, educated Chinese opinion became resentful of the pompous Western criticism of China as it developed rapidly. We talk about like who, when, their administrations as somehow liberal. That's just another word for free trade. Now, there weren't just two options, you know, Maoist on the one hand or Marxist on the one hand and free traders on the other. You did have a diversity of opinion within the party that at the time had something like 30 million members. But you did have a consensus. A minimal consensus was that, first, the Communist Party should maintain control of the state apparatus, and two, that its oversight over the market transition should not be reversed. And so within these confines, you had a tremendous foment of political theory. Maoism itself was a foreign ideology imposed on China. It was not an authoritarian one. It was a totalitarian one. And you want to talk about nationalism. You're talking about both the state and the ethnic group, or the nation proper, the ethnos, a group based on language and the tradition within which that language grew. But for China, national identity could have and could maintain these self-governing ethnic units, but a great diversity of communities and families. And the different ethnicities and cultures are a matter of self-government and decentralization, and that was going on at the same time. But Sun Yat-sen, often portrayed as a liberal in the West, did accept and even promoted Han ethnic identity as being critical. Prior to that, you had regional identities. Regional identities that the Opium War and everything that came afterward discredited. Now, the Han nation is enormous. That's the majority of the population to be mobilized against the foreign, at the time, Manchu government. He was Han. The overwhelming number of people living in China are Han. But he states that the northern, southern, and even the overseas Han people were all Chinese, which is, you know, a minimal claim because they're all speaking the same language, despite the differences between Cantonese and Mandarin. Now, the non-Han people of China are a tiny percentage of the population, but their territories comprise about 64% of all of China, including and especially the very important borderlands where the West has been particularly active. While Han China is the overwhelming majority, ethnically speaking, other ethnic groups had to be allowed autonomous status, or China would be fairly small. Now, after the revolution in 1911, this was very different from 1949, Sun tried to unify the Han, Manchu, Mongolian, Tibetan, and Islamic identities. So the former monarchy's territory is Chinese. However, with these different identities, the boundaries of the nation in this case were difficult, but at least, he advocated, as you have today, autonomous status for these various places, Tibet, etc. But as the Chinese economy took off, regionalism then had room to grow. Still had under party control, but was very, it managed its own affairs. So there was a search for an educated moral authority. Now, I'm not going to talk about Confucius. I know very little about him. I don't spend much time on this kind of thing. But there is a medieval tradition in China, whether it be statecraft, science, that could be evoked against liberalism, liberal democracy, because that would be a victory of the West and capital. Technically, and at least on paper, liberalism is an ideology in the negative. Negative, not positive, freedoms. But in its actual practice, it's based on capital, Darwinism, authoritarianism, and it's that form of rule based around free trade, which is another way of saying the colonization of the country by foreigners. Proper leadership, you have this in medieval everywhere. Proper leadership, righteous governance, is authoritarian, of course, but not totalitarian by any means. Slowly bringing the common population to their own orderly and prosperous society, with this elite backing a powerful state. So it's not just a matter of imposing peace, but an orderly society. The Opium Wars are usually forgotten. And if you've forgotten about what those are, go back to my lecture on that from a few years ago. But the Opium Wars in China were also a form of trauma that shaped what it is to be Chinese today. And there's no way that's been forgotten, because it was such a tremendous humiliation. And prior to the 1911 revolution, basic theoretical legitimacy was there to protect people's right to subsistence, economic betterment, and basic fundamentals, the responsibilities of what we could call citizenship. Western imperialism forced this, though, on any rational person. Although, to be honest with you, the state is far more powerful in the West than it is in China. Now, I want to direct you to the 20th Congress of the Communist Party in 1922. And this full report is called Hold High the Great Banner of Socialism with Chinese Characteristics and Strive in Unity to Build a Modern Socialist Country in All Respects. October 16th, 2022. And this is about exactly the problems that we're talking about. The party is modernizing the economy, but only within the context of a harmonious national and spiritual culture. There are all kinds of economic and ideological paths that can lead to different forms of development. But we're not talking about abstract ideology imposed from a foreign power, like liberalism or Marxism would be. But what she mentions in this report is a total break with Marx and a total break with liberalism. There are similar ideologies, as we've spoken of in this show many times. And one of the things they have in common is that they see themselves as being above reproach. They are the voice of history. Neither Marxism nor liberal democracy or free trade, neither one tolerates any opposition to their fundamental assumptions and interests. Like Marxism, the neoliberal capitalist mentality holds that only one path to modernization is possible, and that liberalism itself can never be questioned or rejected. And in the Western world, those dissenters are prosecuted, often with prison terms. And in many cases, foreign media, like the Russian media, is banned outright, which is, by the way, not the case in China. We know what happens to a country that wants to break the Washington consensus or the BlackRock consensus. It becomes a target of color revolutions, sanctions, even military attack. But the West has such a caricaturist view of both the Russians and the Chinese that they have provoked a form of self-sufficiency, that alliance of resistance, much of Central Asia, including Iran, now India, China, Russia, much of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, is a synthesis of nationalism, anti-imperialism, and some variant of non-materialist or non-Marxist socialism. And it includes a strengthening of the state sector of the economy, or state-owned and or state-controlled companies, forming the core of a specifically Chinese plan of development. China is a success story. Any of these other movements, usually financed by the West, they have to answer the question of what they can do better. How can they engage in faster or more equitable development than the Chinese Communist Party has? And that's a very tall order. China is in an excellent position right now to remake the developing world. The Russian Mikhail Dilagin, who used to be the deputy chair of the Russian Duma Committee on Economic Policy, stated that the Chinese were able to creatively adapt the Marxism of the 19th century and its experience of the 20th century to new requirements and implement eternal values with new methods. This is a very important and useful lesson for us. But one of these experiences is the importance of nationalism and the spiritual culture of a people, any people. So in Xi's report, the 20th Congress, he talks about the overarching concept of Chinese foreign policy. And one of them is the Belt and Road Initiative, its trade path across Eurasia and really the entire world. And the way that's described, not in the report specifically, but the foreign ministry talks about what the BRI is. And they say the Belt and Road Initiative transcends the outdated mentality of geopolitical games and created a new model of international cooperation. It is not an exclusive group that excludes other participants, but an open and inclusive cooperation platform. It's not just China's solo effort, but a symphony performed by all participating countries. I think it's interesting that he uses the word symphony. When he mentions game, he's referring to the zero-sum game. That seems to be an inherent part of liberalism. Zero sum, that someone succeeds only at the expense of someone else. But the BRI is based on ethnic diversity, multilateralism, and non-interference in how other states are governed. The very opposite of what liberalism is. Liberalism, being a revolutionary ideology, wants to export itself. China's trade now through this is, well, back when I first wrote this, it was $13 trillion. It's much higher than that, and much of it derives from actual manufacture, not in the West, these financial or fictitious growth instruments. Organizations that I've been talking about for a long time, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, BRICS, the Eurasian Economic Union, this is the response of the land power to the rule of the sea, you know, symbolically speaking. It is the alternative to the Washington consensus, which relies on threats, sanctions, and violence in order to function. And this consensus is a left revolutionary doctrine, as the French Revolutionary doctrine was. The Western Empire is now relying on strip mining, existing capital, and even the assets of its wealthy allies, importing all these hostile young male refugees from Africa and Asia are a means to silence working class revolt. My God, Ukraine is being depopulated to fight the Russian nationalist challenge. Spike in crime is used. It's an alienating factor. It keeps the men of the West at home, off balance, and without confidence. And as we all know, even mild criticism of this is met with prison sentences. Back to Xi's report. I want to quote him. This is page 15. To uphold and develop Marxism, we must integrate it with China's fine traditional culture. Only by taking root in the rich historical and cultural soil of the country and the nation can the truth of Marxism flourish here. With a history stretching back to antiquity, China's fine traditional culture is extensive and profound, the crystallization of the wisdom of Chinese civilization. Our traditional culture espouses many important principles, including pursuing common good, the common good for all, regarding the people as the foundation of the state, governing by virtue, discarding the outdated in favor of the new, selecting officials on the basis of merit, promoting harmony between humanity and nature, ceaselessly pursuing self-improvement, embracing the world with virtue, acting in good faith and being friendly to others, and fostering neighborliness. These maxims, which have taken shape over centuries of work and life, reflect the Chinese people's way of viewing the universe, the world, society, and morality, and are highly consistent with the propositions of scientific socialism. So much of this, it sounds like harmless platitudes, but they're not. Marxism is not even the issue. It's a meaningless term in this context. Socialism is not, but Marxism is. But what he said here is not trite platitudes. By the way, nothing he mentioned above is found in the market economy, and certainly not in the Darwinian system, which undergirds the Western world. Virtue, or the common good, as he mentions, that's anti-liberal. That's bad for business. It's impractical. I mean, slogan, liberals may use those slogans, but only as propaganda, not serious priorities. Western mass society dominated by media and propaganda. And in my book, I have an entire section on the nature of propaganda and how it's used. It has long destroyed any conception of a rational self or a community that creates healthy selves. Liberalism has no conception of a hierarchy of values, since everything is reducible to money or some quantitative advantage. This same Party Congress reiterated five bedrock axioms of Chinese foreign policy. And these are: 1, mutual respect for sovereignty and territorial integrity. 2, mutual non-aggression. 3, non-interference in the internal affairs of other nations. 4, equality and mutual benefit. And finally, 5, peaceful coexistence. Now, again, to the American ear, it's just platitudinous. But what a scholar is supposed to do is be able to read into this and get to the root of its meaning. It is, in my opinion, a brief manifesto for social nationalism. It's a repudiation of the idea that nationalism is somehow violent. But the truth, of course, is that only imperialism, especially liberal imperialism, is inherently violent and militarist. You can't be a consistent nationalist if you want to destroy or damage another nation, all other factors being equal. Like everything else, liberalism's connection to the nation is just rhetorical. It's empty. Yeah, the Western ruling class, the regime, uses nationalism from time to time. Like in Ukraine, for example, Jewish nationalism is always dominant. But especially things like black or Ukrainian nationalism, these are means of harming liberalism's enemies. Now, let me talk about specifically in that Congress, what the party has to say about nationalism. This is from page 3334. The people's support of the utmost political importance, and the unified front is an effective instrument for rallying the people's support and pooling their strength. We will build a broad united front to forge great unity and solidarity. We will encourage the sons and daughters of the Chinese nation to dedicate themselves to realizing the Chinese dream of national rejuvenation. We will leverage the strength of our country's new type of socialist political party system. Following the principles of long-term coexistence, mutual oversight, sincerity, and sharing the rough times and the smooth, we will strengthen our party's unity and cooperation with other political parties and prominent figures without party affiliation. We will, with a focus on forging a strong sense of community for the Chinese nation, continue to take the correct and distinctively Chinese approach to handling ethnic affairs, uphold and improve the system of regional ethnic autonomy, and improve the party's work on ethnic affairs so as to comprehensively promote ethnic unity and progress. We'll also remain committed to the principle that religions in China must be Chinese in orientation and provide active guidance to the religions in China so they can adapt to socialist society. We will cultivate cordial and clean relationships between government and business across the board and facilitate the healthy development of the non-public sector and those working in it. Now, I quoted at length in the book, because despite its, you know, how it sounds, these are not platitudes. It's another very brief manifesto of this very new form of government. Yeah, there's certain ideological expressions that are tolerated, but it will stop short of tolerating anti-Chinese and destructive ideologies, including liberalism. A public ideology, in other words, can't be wholly foreign, as Marxism-Leninism was, to everyone, which is not an unreasonable demand. In 1984, Deng Xiaoping said this concerning the ideological justification for this new path. Moving away from Mao, he says, "What is socialism? What is Marxism? We were not quite clear about this in the past. Marxism attaches utmost importance to developing the productive forces. We have said that socialism is a primary stage of communism, that at the advanced stage, the principle of from each according to his ability and to each according to his need will be applied. This calls for highly developed productive forces and an overwhelming abundance of material wealth. Therefore, the fundamental task for the socialist stage is to develop the productive forces. The superiority of the socialist system is demonstrated in the final analysis by faster and greater development of those forces than under the capitalist system. And as they develop, the people's material and cultural life will constantly improve. One of our shortcomings after the founding of the People's Republic was that we didn't pay enough attention to developing the productive forces. Socialism means eliminating poverty. Pauperism is not socialism, still less communism." Now, the concept of socialist civilization, it's a Chinese construct. It's related to the concept of the party as the representative of the Chinese nation. It has nothing to do with Marx, nothing to do with Mao. It replaces the notion of a struggle between two classes in industry with the harmony that derives from ethnic and national culture. The existence of classes is absolutely unavoidable, something that even Mao admitted. The concept here is protecting China and the party from foreign liberal influences. And that is seen as the highest form of representation. The very fact that they use the word spiritual is a definite symbol. It's a move away from the materialism, which are behind both liberal and Marxist ideologies. The spiritual side of civilization is independent from the rest of society and serves as its foundation rather than being its creation. And that's the most anti-communist and anti-liberal idea you can imagine. The three represents in 2004, developed by the party, is: one, represent the development trend of China's advanced productive forces; two, represent the orientation of China's advanced culture; and three, represent the fundamental interest of the overwhelming majority of the Chinese people. Now, that doesn't sound like much, but that is the rejection of a class-based understanding of history, Marxist economics as a whole. The culture is a foundation for society, and something specifically Chinese that has to exist along with the growth of any form of socialism, national or otherwise. In fact, that's the precondition for any national development, and the only ideology that rejects it is liberalism. By using the phrase overwhelming majority, the party is deliberately rejecting reductionist terms like the proletariat and Marxism in general. And all this has to be understood in context. The regime has been beating the drums for war with China for a long time. And just like in 1940, 1941 against Japan, the U.S. is attempting to cut off China's access to certain raw materials, which it can never succeed in doing. But the foe they will face is not some small militarist hegemon facing a unified industrial giant, but China, a legitimate superpower facing a dying empire. So the ultimate purpose of any American war is to weaken the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and to take over the behemoth that is modern China. And this is nothing new. Before World War I, the Rothschilds looked at Berlin and Petrograd with anger as threats to the British Empire. Liberal powers always have viewed themselves as having this Darwinian right to rule the world. In the 1920s and 1930s, the British had the temerity to condemn Japan's invasion of Manchuria as an attack on national sovereignty. I'm going to talk about how preposterous that sounds given the size of the British Empire. And I quote a writer I've quoted before, Joachim Hagopian, And here's what he has to say back in 2016. The empire's naked neocolonial aggression involved exploiting unlimited energy resources anywhere in the world while neutralizing key enemies as America's predatory vested self-interest, or more accurately, the parasitic ruling elite self-interest only, clearly neither America nor Americans nor any Asian countries. Because the world's only superpower has gotten away with raping and pillaging the planet at will for decades, the empire is banking on its retaining its global unipolar dominance for years to come by more of these same tactics. That's the context. And we know that a lot of this isn't true. Trying to bottle up the Chinese Navy is absolutely impossible for the U.S. To isolate and destroy China, just like it tried to do with Germany and Russia in years past. You have the opinion of Mark Morris of the U.S. National War College. He advocates, and the Pentagon is still talking about this, offshore controlling. Chinese seaborne imports and exports are reduced. Factory production drops and millions of workers are laid off. Soon the numbers soar to tens of millions and perhaps 100 million. Now, he's talking about what this bottling up is going to do in China. When jobs are not found, they start protesting. Now the Chinese Communist Party is faced with tens of millions of unemployed protesters. It will try to blame some enemy that can't be seen. Not believing the party, discontent grows and protests increase. The Chinese Communist Party orders the People's Liberation Army to break the blockade, but the People's Liberation Army and Navy replies that China doesn't have the right type of navy and are unable to comply with these orders. Now, this is the ultimate goal of American foreign policy. I should really say the intermediate goal of American foreign policy in China, isolate China. This idiot is given it's pure projection. This very well is what's going to happen in the U.S. This is such a simplified, sophomoric, oversimplified analysis. And how these people seem to think the U.S. remains a superpower that has the capability of enforcing anything like this. What's Walmart going to do without cheap Chinese-made goods? Anything like this, the Chinese would blame the West. This rhetoric that I just quoted, 2013, is a fantasy. It relies on the assumption that the world is unified in supporting American aims. Fantasy passes for political analysis today. What I just read to you is a result of sanctions placed on China. That's what he thinks is going to happen. And of course, that is pure fantasy. Unfortunately for Washington, there are plenty of places led by the Russo-Chinese alliance that are unwilling to become minor impoverished cogs in the American machine. Nationalism, at least in terms of government, especially in the third world, in practical terms, is the refusal to become low-wage colonies for Western corporations. That's the very concept of outsourcing. That very concept shows itself when major capitalist enterprises set up shop abroad and use cheaper labor and poor regulation to boost profits by importing those goods back into the U.S. The total globalization of production and distribution means that the highest possible profits can be earned since all transaction costs have been minimized. There's a lot of assumptions there. The entrenchment of neoliberal economics on a global scale requires more than traditional armies or military forces. It requires metaphorical soldiers, as Hossein Zadeh said in 2016, WTO, the IMF, central banks, credit rating agencies, and the media as a whole. But to do this, to attempt to control the Chinese in this regard, is completely irrational. Modern liberalism redistributes national income in favor of the wealthy, undermines the formation of public capital, weakens national defenses against natural disasters, accumulates national debt, and threatens financial stability, spoils external or foreign markets for non-military U.S. transnational capital, undermines civil liberties and fosters dependence or addiction to military spending and therefore leads to a spiraling vicious circle of war and militarism. Those are the marks of imperial liberalism, or parasitic imperialism. Local elites in any country colonized by corporate capitalism, they have to promote the ideologies favored by capital, which of course invariably is liberal democracy, with a strong focus on quashing non-liberal dissent. And it's quite consistent with liberalism. Free markets based on self-interest, there is no content there. That ideology has no means to oppose the purchase of monetary policy, or even entire governments by private actors. I mean, building a financial structure that uses debt to leverage more debt, that is, until the chances of repayment are non-existent, those are rational for those with the ability to profit from them. Over time, bad loans and the assets to which they are attached become the property of the regime, since they're created by it in the first place. What China is facing is the crisis truly of imperialism, or imperial parasitism, overstretch, endless war. In the Ukrainian case, Ukraine was colonized to ensure the transfer of her assets to the West as debt service, to encircle and threaten Russia, and to deindustrialize the country, rendering it just a raw materials producer. In other words, what Western banks, especially the BlackRock investment management combine, did in Ukraine, they want to impose that on China and Russia as a whole. And Russia, unlike China, has already been through this already. But China has a stake in America's debt. But Western imperial power is in serious trouble. I mentioned a long time ago that the Industrial and Commercial Bank of China began operations in Moscow in 2017 with the sole purpose to act as a new intermediary for international commodity and energy trade. Iran has joined it as well. The yuan is a reserve currency, officially, as far as the Russian economy is concerned. But the U.S. has no financial weapons to answer the massive drop in demand for the dollar once this kind of thing is made operational. The sanctions and the endless wars have permitted the SCO and BRICS to aim towards self-reliance. If the big creditors or the big credit agencies pulled out of Russia, local alternatives are all over the place. Any nation under American sanctions doesn't use the SWIFT system, that computer module that governs international trade and credit, controlled by bankers from in Belgium. That's the manifestation of the cooperation of the globe's financial elites. And the MIR structure in Russia has removed the BlackRock and Rothschild presence from the country. The mentality behind the Great Reset is that thought that BRICS is something that it could guide or control, and they were wrong. This axis of resistance is buying up gold all over the place. And the SCO has a degree of independence unthinkable 20 years ago. Now, what is China countering with? Why do I say it's a national socialist economy? Well, a key factor in this economy are the state-owned enterprises. They function as a mechanism through which foreign firms have to transfer technology in order to gain Chinese market access. In other words, China will not grant access to its own market without a price, and the West sees this as absolutely intolerable. So, for example, in the early 2000s, China was building its energy grid to meet very, very rapidly booming demand. GE wanted to enter this market. But because they're facing the state, not other private actors, they had to deal with a different kind of reality. The top executives in state firms are appointed effectively by the party. So if the party wants to create an indigenous Chinese manufacturing industry capable of producing high-tech products for energy plants like turbines that can compete with GE and Siemens, then the head of a Chinese power company can insist that any supplier of turbines transfer valuable technology to indigenous Chinese suppliers. That's the economy of the common good from the Chinese point of view, as opposed to plutocracy. A GE had to buckle, because the Chinese market is too big to ignore. the short-term costs of refusing to play by Chinese rules are very high. Because if GE had rejected these rules, then another company may have taken its place. To be self-sufficient may be great for the people of every country on the planet, but it's definitely a crime in the eyes of the West. China is not only independent, but as Peter Koenig wrote in 2018, China dares to introduce to the world a totally new system in which private companies are subservient to the interests of the state and hence the nation. This is a total opposite of what is happening in the West and its client states, where governments are actually indebted to private companies and where people exist mainly in order to generate huge corporate profits. On top of it, China's population is educated, enthusiastic, patriotic, and incredibly productive. So in the competition with the West, this form of state is winning the competition. And it does it without plundering the world, without overthrowing foreign governments and starving people. And this is seen by the U.S. as unfair competition and the rhetorical foundation of sanctions, threats, and all kinds of provocation. The regime calls it unfair because China refuses to join and play by the old imperialist rules, which were accepted by Japan and South Korea, especially South Korea after the military fell. And it's not even that China wants to set new rules. It just realizes that the Western world, that is to say, liberalism, does more damage than it provides in benefits. If you remember, in the first Trump administration, Sino-American trade war was declared, and it backfired completely. So in January of 2019, Apple cut its revenue guidance, talking about weak iPhone sales and trying to pin that blame on the Chinese. When you declare a trade war, many companies are going to take a hit. Well, America's post-Cold War strategy for dealing with China is rooted in liberal ideas. In other words, free trade. That this is a presumed universal idea, this irresistible power. This is what freedom is as far as the West is concerned. But the leadership in China is dedicated to preserving the party's monopoly on domestic political power for the sake of the common good. Now, using phrases like monopoly on powers is misleading. But as I've said many times before, news reports almost monthly on the coming collapse of China is just a means of projecting American failure onto its enemies. And it's a very common tactic in the tightly controlled media in the West. But the new Silk Road, as I've already mentioned, it's a radical restructuring of the globe's economy. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the most significant political organization in the East, you know, you're not going to hear this mentioned in these stupid presidential debates, largely because, among other reasons, it's the organization of most of the world's population against American liberal imperialism. It's about the Russo-Chinese building of their own financial infrastructure, creating a new banking system without Western usury. And they're offering credit to places like, you know, the third world in Africa and Asia without the political ideologies attached to the Western version. Investment barriers against China exists in the land of free trade ideology because China is refusing to obey the hegemon's rules. The Western world can't compete with social nationalist China. And a lot of this I wrote long before 2020, long before the war, the sanctions on Russia, and what that's meant for the European economies. If none of that ever happened, the West still couldn't compete. Western elites rely on short-term speculation and finance or real estate insurance without the industrial base that it has sent abroad. Reliance on military conquest or empire building absorbed public resources. China has directed its domestic resources towards innovative and advanced technology and the common good. One of the most outlandish admissions as to general American ill will is from the Council on Foreign Relations. They put out something in 2015 called Revising U.S. Grand Strategy Towards China. And one of its complaints is that the Chinese seek to, quote, cast doubt on the U.S. economic model as part of the agenda. Let me quote them here directly. This is a key passage. The fundamental conclusion for the U.S., therefore, is that China does not see its interests served by becoming just another trading state, no matter how constructive an outcome that might be for resolving the larger tensions between its economic and geopolitical strategies. Instead, China will continue along the path of becoming a conventional great power with the full panoply of political and military capabilities, all oriented towards realizing the goal of recovering from the United States the primacy it once enjoyed in Asia as a prelude to exerting global influence in the future. Now, the assumption behind this, and much writing like this, is that the U.S. has, or liberalism as a whole, has the inherent right to dominate the globe. And any other power seeking to supplant that is an enemy. China has no desire, certainly, to harm the U.S. economically. In fact, for now at least, China's connection with the American market is substantial, although that's changing, not just because of massive debt, but simply because of the development of China's own internal market. Council on Foreign Relations is infamously a huge pillar of the regime. It's a cross-section of the regime, in fact. And that's why I consider that article official doctrine. And the report itself says that the U.S. should intensify its naval and air presence in the South and East China Seas. That's American policy now. Increasing U.S. military capabilities on China's doorstep using Taiwan. Not to mention Japan. And Japan's military apparatus to be expanded greatly. And it's, you know, before Pearl Harbor, you had the same American policy of trade restriction, forcing Tokyo to take a hostile posture. That report from the CFR says that the U.S. should encourage these countries to develop a coordinated approach to constrict China's access to all technologies, including dual use, that can inflict high-leverage strategic harm. To establish a new technology regime towards China, Washington should enter into an immediate discussion with allies and friends with the aim of tightening restrictions on the sales of militarily critical technologies to China, including dual-use technologies. This will obviously not be easy to accomplish, but the effort should get underway immediately. Again, this is fantasy. So many nations are dependent on China. The same nations see the U.S. as too indebted to have really much freedom of action. Since 2020, the rapid collapse of the European economy renders the EU really without authority. They have limited resources with which to threaten China, which, by the way, the EU has long enjoyed prosperous trade relations. So now, let me get to the heart of the matter. China is not a communist country. It hasn't been one for a very long time. Let me give you the marks that any Leninist or Maoist or communist economy or society has to have. Central planning over all, if not most, of the economy, party monopoly on all economic production, a ban on all private enterprise and media, centralization of all power in one place, the lack of stable law, in other words, the party is the law, forced agricultural collectivization into collective farms, the desire to export revolution, the planned destruction of all pre-revolutionary forms of cultural life, mass anti-dissident purges with great loss of life, a ban on all forms of ethno-nationalism except as an instrumental means, socialist realism in art, total lack of privacy, official atheism, the destruction of churches, and an officially materialist ideology enforced by one party claiming to represent the end of history. Now, Mao had all of those marks. In fact, he helped define them. Today's China has none of them. The USA has far more of these marks than China does. Maoism was a more extreme example of Stalinist collectivization. From 1958 to 1962, Mao and his clique plunged the country into starvation. By the party's own records, at least 40 million people were killed as a result. Party activists with no knowledge of agriculture were placed in charge of these collective units, and that was going to be the cell of the new socialist man. The family was eliminated, children raised in state-run nurseries, even sexual activity tightly regulated by the state. So it didn't take long for the country to run out of food, and the little that was grown was sent to the Soviet Union to pay debt. So production was falling, the quotas imposed by the party were increasing. The resulting poverty and destruction was beyond anything that we could imagine. Collective farms were full of emaciated people by the midst of Mao's rule. And Mao ordered them to build their own steel plants, quote-unquote, made out of clay in their backyards. And everything that could be melted down was melted down. China underwent the greatest destruction of buildings in world history. Everything was burnt to create what was laughable, unusable steel. China was almost totally deforested. Wood was burnt in huge quantities for these backyard steel plants. That was Maoism. Eventually, key party elements turned on him. And the Cultural Revolution was Mao's answer. And he had his own Antifa, the Red Guards. And they were then mobilized and sent into the countryside to attack all dissidents. Now, Deng Xiaoping was condemned for his rejection of Mao. The Gang of Four, who took over immediately after Mao's death, wanted to continue Mao's agenda, but due to its being condemned by all sectors of the country, that was simply impossible. Mao's last wife was a leader of the gang, and they ultimately were all purged as traitors in 1981 during a show trial that they used many times against their enemies. They're all dead now, and the transcripts have never been released. Deng Xiaoping was the transitional figure to reject the Maoist ideology. Greater freedom was prohibited. The military had its budget cut drastically. Smooth relations between Taipei and Beijing. Investment from the island to the mainland was encouraged. And as I've quoted already, the spiritual socialist, the social nationalist approach, using the best of socialism and the best of nationalism, not to mention the market, to transform China, which had been a fourth world devastated country, transforming it into a first world powerhouse in what, 15 years? Using the phrase Communist Party is misleading, and it certainly doesn't mean that they're Leninists. Communist is an old term in Russia and in China. It doesn't have much meaning. It's like the American Civil Liberties Union. That's ridiculous. They said nothing about the lockdowns. The formerly ruling dominant Japanese party was a liberal democratic party. So these names really shouldn't be taken all that seriously. You have other parties, like the China National Democratic Construction Association, China Association for Promoting Democracy, and many others. And they're not so much competitors for power, but they have millions of members. They're critical of the government, but they tend to specialize in policy areas. So 2 years after Mao's death, a new Chinese constitution was written. China then became national, not Marxian, socialist. And the third plenum of the 11th Party Congress in 1978 is when this was institutionalized. Ultimately leading to what Jiang Zemin called socialism with Chinese characteristics. Modernizing the forces of production and markets became a priority, while a law-based society connected to Han nationalism came second. The socialist democracy under the party and making the people the masters of the country. In other words, socialist culture with Chinese characteristics was to build a strong national idea, which would inculcate the ideals, moral integrity, education, strong sense of discipline, and developing a nationally based scientific and popular socialist culture. Patriotism is absolutely essential to this movement. Deng Xiaoping said that economic planning was not identical with socialism. Early in his rule, he said that planning and market forces are not the essential difference between socialism and capitalism. A planned economy is not the definition of socialism because there is planning under capitalism. The market economy happens under socialism too. Planning and market forces are both ways of controlling economic activity. One of the core ideas of the party now in China is that Marx and Engels never formulated any theory on the development of the non-Western world. In other words, the European or Judaic theory on industry has no relevance to China. Liberalism has always been a violent, totalitarian, and imperial ideology, as was Soviet and Maoist Leninism. Nationalism filled in the gaps, as references to Marx, Lenin, and Mao were minimized, then and now. These were symbols, if nothing else. Ideology was cast aside in favor of pragmatism, but that's usually not enough. Socialism did not mean shared poverty, as Deng Xiaoping said. Mao had to be abandoned, but slowly. And decentralization was one of the essential elements. But under the so-called Communist Party, economic freedom was encouraged at all levels of government. Huge sectors were open to both private investment and market forces. But the party defines the boundaries to this, and it maintains the stability required to prevent a Jacobin capitalist class developing, as I've said already. Social nationalist states like Singapore, Taiwan, South Korea, when they were under their military or authoritarian governments, were studied carefully. Deng Xiaoping had to admit that Taiwan's per capita GDP was 300% larger than China's, so Marxist doctrine simply had to go. They advocated not the collectivization of Mao, but a great degree of centralization in the countryside. The family was officially pronounced as master of the land, held privately or at least communally rather than state-run or foreign-run. Profit incentives rather than state coercion motivates production then and now, and it increased agricultural output. It then stimulated industrial development, because this is ultimately the surpluses where industry is financed. But in this transitional stage, only social nationalism could hold the country together. In Eastern Europe, the Soviet Union, it didn't coalesce quickly enough after the Soviet collapse. So China was spared the evils of Western capitalism. So the party's embrace of the market economy, or at least the rejection of planning, they rejected state pricing in 1992. But they maintained planning only in the most general sense, with flexibility for actors to exercise autonomy, rather than laying out a recipe for what has to happen. Plans in a command economy order directly enterprises to accomplish or a sector to accomplish a certain goal. General plans in the Chinese case, these are state-directed economies. They set goals for whole industries. They target investment money rather than command it directly. Tiananmen Square, again, no massacre occurred there, but that was China's answer to liberalism. That's the line that the party drew, and did so again in the protests in Hong Kong a few years ago. Liberalism leads to plutocracy, and plutocracy can't handle decentralization any more than Stalinism could. The party remains strong to foster very explicitly what makes China unique, what rendered China capable of surviving so much violence and oppression, whether domestically or from foreigners. You can't be an individualist under such conditions. You could privatize certain areas only if the state is stronger than any group of wealthy insiders that can exploit the process, which occurred in the former Soviet Union. So socialism was redefined as a political system that stressed the social over the individual, or even the party, or even the state. Socialism was reclaimed from the left. China's crackdown on crime and drugs, the Strike Hard campaigns, I know I've mentioned those before. Liberalism and the market encourage crime, since it's all about personal self-seeking, which when you institutionalize it is a disorder. It brings out all the self-destructive streaks in antisocial people. All these liberal institutions, the NGOs advocating free love, easy divorce, pornography, feminism, that both Mao and Lenin briefly imposed during the start of their revolutionary regimes. But rather than go the Western route or the Soviet route, early Soviet route, rising divorce rates in the 1990s led to the state trying to keep families together. The Chinese conception of nationalism defined officially by the party, has three levels. The first level, individuals subordinating their personal interests to the interests of the state. The second level, individuals should subordinate their personal destiny to the destiny of the socialist system. And third, individuals should subordinate their personal future to the future of our communist cause. Now, state, in this case, doesn't mean government. It could mean the ethnos. Socialism and communism were dismantled by the time the party made that statement. The people, the nation, refers to Han China, a nationally based economic development layout, the very definition of national socialism. Communism refers to the national, not the international version. But starting in the 1980s, ethnic Han nationalism, Chinese nationalism, became official policy. They went back to the heroic struggle against Western and Japanese imperialism. Patriotic lessons were added to the school curriculum. They sang the national anthem, which was not the Internationale, by the way. 1983, the party stated that among patriotism, collectivism, socialism, or communism, patriotism has peculiar features and functions. Patriotism is the banner of greatest appeal. Deng Xiaoping said, "Some have said that not loving socialism is not the same as not loving one's motherland. Is the motherland something abstract? If you do not love socialist New China led by the Communist Party, then what motherland do you love?" By calling it New China, he declared Mao dead. Nationalism is socialist by its very structure. Individualism is perceived as social disintegration, anything but progress. Deng said, "One cannot demonstrate that one loves the motherland if one shows no deep love to the socialist system and the party. In short, in our times, loving the Communist Party is the highest expression of Chinese patriotism." Social nationalism is pretty much the same as corporatism, and the Chinese economic system can be considered corporatist. But corporatism is connected to social nationalism, trying to mold society into industrial power through overriding markets in favor of shared and national prosperity. A. James Gregor wrote in Italian Fascism and Developmental Dictatorship that fascism is a form of developmental authoritarianism where a non-industrial power mobilizes its resources to become autarkic or self-sufficient in its own industrial development. So people like Gregor connect the new Chinese government to fascism in general. The reforms came after the Gang of Four, brought socialism to a new, ultimately right-wing stage through nationalism. Jiang and Deng Xiaoping created a new infrastructure that permitted the flourishing of private businesses in partnership both the state and the party. The encouragement of small-scale entrepreneurship, which, by the way, is disappearing in the U.S. and the EU. Only large concentrations of capital came directly under state control, like the central bank, which is the arm of the party rather than private bankers. But Xi Jinping talks about the Chinese dream of nationalist resurrection. The Chinese spiritual civilization is now in Chinese law. And the official position is that politics is a battle of ideology or different gods, as Zhang Xingong says. Social nationalism has been put into practice. The state planning boards representing different sectors of the economy are very limited in their coercive abilities. So the system constructed today in China allows the creation of a real meritocracy. Everything in social life is a complex, interconnected organism with many different parts composing a national whole. China is far more democratic in the true sense of the word and representative than the U.S., which is a totalitarian system using state-protected leftist groups rather than government agencies to carry out the work of violent repression, no different than the Red Guards did in the Chinese Cultural Revolution. The U.S. is highly centralized in its media and ideology and economics. China is not. What developed here is a form of development-focused nationalism mixed with a variant of state socialism, which, if you use the corporation and the union as intermediaries, is the very definition of national socialism. These all come from, now in 2024, great success from Sun Yat-sen, to German Romantics, modern populists, the Chinese tradition itself, older than all of them. National Socialism is not fascism, but this has been. When you have an ethnically more or less pure Han society, the choice of the developing world in general. And I think I've made it clear what Chinese socialism is, and it's a national socialism. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.